And my point at the end of the day is we be in a better place if people acknowledge the privileges that we did have and double down on that when it came to making things happen towards this tangible equity goal.
Hello and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Colin Seal on the show. Colin is the founder and CEO of Think Law. Colin was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, where his struggle gave birth to his passion for educational equity. Using lessons from his experience as a math teacher, attorney, and keynote speaker, he helps educators teach critical thinking to all students, regardless of race or achievement, through his award-winning organization, Think Law. Colin is also the author of Thinking Like a Lawyer, and his latest book, which is the topic of our chat today, is called Tangible Equity. In this episode, I talked to Colin about tangible equity in education. For Colin, real equity work should help reduce the predictive power of demographics on outcomes. In order to do that, he argues we need to teach kids how to think for themselves so that they can learn to question instead of comply with unfair systems. Colin shares concrete actions that educators can take to contribute towards tangible equity. We also touch on the topics of privilege, race, bias, and gifted education. It's always a great time chatting with Colin. He's a really thoughtful and passionate guy, and I think he's making some really important changes in the education system. So without further ado, I bring you Colin Seal.
How are you, man?
I'm great. It's been a while.
Yeah, man. Man, I really enjoyed reading through your book, man. I read it back in July, like full thing. First, I just kind of read a couple of chapters, whatever. But man, I'm so inspired after reading that book, man. I'm so
Transcend?
Excited. Yeah.
Transcend?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
Thank you.
So good. When you think about what I think about for my children, right? When I think about like for the world and the teachers we work with, whatever, it's like, man, whew, just setting a higher bar. Setting a higher bar. I mean, I love it. It's so, it's the hugest breath of fresh air I've had in a long time.
Wow. That made my day. Thank you. Talk about setting a higher bar in this discourse. I loved your new book, Tangible Equity. Congratulations. Congratulations on the publication. A lot leading up to that book. It brings together lots of your prior ideas. I mean, you've been on this podcast before. This is a repeat performer on the podcast. But in our last discussion, we talk about a lot of these issues as well, which are in this book. But this book brings together lots more threads and a lot more of your thinking since then. The subtitle of your book is A Guide for Leveraging Student Identity, Culture, and Power to Unlock Excellence in and Beyond the Classroom. I think like this idea of equity, I'd love to get your thoughts on your latest thinking about how you define that term, and maybe how it differs from how some other people define it.
I love it. So I think it's important to start by saying, like, when we first spoke, my first book wasn't even out, right? This Thinking Like a Lawyer book hadn't even come out yet before. And a lot of the work that I've been leading in the last 7 years since I started this organization, Think Law, was how do we close the critical thinking gap in education? How do we make sure that all kids have access to critical thinking? Because of my firm belief that when our kids learn how to lead, how to innovate, how to break what needs to be broken, it's a very different level of consuming education and living and not just surviving, but thriving in our world. So that's the work we've been doing with, you know, districts and school systems all over the nation. And when it comes to equity, I'm so glad that we're starting with this question because we are in a really weird space. People can say whatever and call it equity, right? We can say, hey, I am going to, you saw this so often during COVID. We got to make sure we keep schools closed because equity. Oh, no, we have to really make sure we reopen schools because of equity. Oh, let's make sure we shut down that Gifted and Talented program, equity. Let's make sure we expand opportunity to advanced academics, equity. So let's be really clear. When I say equity work, I think about the work that we do that reduces the predictive power that demographics have on outcomes. So if we're doing equity work, we're doing the kinds of things that are resulting in reducing the predictive power that demographics have on outcomes. This means that no matter where you're listening from, if you live in a community where you can say things like the other side of the tracks, south of the interstate, north of the interstate, if you've got this thing where, oh, there's that trailer park community over there, there's that community where most people speak that language, the community where most people are that skin color, those kids in your school that have that little thing on their record that said that they're this type of student, if it's no longer the case that so many of those demographic markers can lead to these sorts of predictive outcomes, we're doing the type of disruptive equity work that I mean when we say equity. So what I like about that definition is it is really inclusive. I've never met an educator in any community who's felt like, oh yeah, we don't do that here. Of course you do. We're all trying to reduce predictive capacity that demographics tend to have on outcomes, no matter where we work.
This has been your mission for years. I mean, you've said right in your mission statement, I remember like, what, 5-6 years ago, like regardless of your zip code, regardless of, you know, what side of the tracks you're on, I believe you said that at one point. This has been in your heart and mind for a really long time. Do you feel like the past couple of years, it's you've gotten even more like passionate about it or more because you're fired up right now. Look at you. I love it. You know, are you even more fired up right now than you were before? Like, are there world events, things that have you're like, this is the time for me to really get this message out there?
If you haven't been in a reflective space in the last 2 years, it's be really surprising to me, right? Because there's so many things about the last 2 years that kind of forces that reflection. But one of the things that I've learned to really, really question over the last 2 years is this idea around what success looks like, what success actually means. Because for me, growing up how I grew up, growing up in a struggle, growing up on free and reduced lunch, having a dad incarcerated for selling drugs, growing up with some of the behavior challenges I had when I was in my primary grades, the idea that I'm doing what I do now can seem like this miraculous success, right? And I see these stories all the time and I'm like, yeah, you know, we really got to work hard. We really got to push towards outcomes because, as I've argued before, the outcome is part of the opportunity, right? When we make sure that disruptive work is focused on those outcomes lead to more opportunities for populations whose lives can be transformed by those outcomes that lead to those opportunities. But then part of what I started to buckle up against, and I have a piece that I wrote for the 74 that explained like why I wrote Tangible Equity. I started to feel like there's a cost to this work. There's a cost to this model that says, hey, depending on where you are in our world, you might have to work twice as hard to get half as far in certain kinds of constraints, right? Maybe because of gender or ability issues or, you know, racial injustice issues. You've got this two-tiered system that requires extraordinary effort from some folks to get what would normally be looked at as ordinary results. And honestly, Scott, I started to feel it. I started to feel this level of exhaustion. I started to question, why did I start going bald at 21 years old? It doesn't even run in my family. Why is my prostate as an almost 40-year-old person where it should be when I'm in my mid-60s? Why is my blood pressure spiking up to this level of height? And I start looking at this thing. Dr. Charles Cole has a book that's called Beyond Grit and Resilience. And he talks about this idea of the Black achievement trauma tax. And when I read this book and I started looking at it, and I heard him speak at a conference once, he talked about when he experiences a failure, when he has a small setback, he starts to smell the homeless shelter. He can still smell it. This man has his doctorate, right? And he can still smell it. And I think about what is the cost of creating this space of telling you your answer to the injustice in front of you is to just put your head down and grit and resilience your way through it. That was kind of what I had been on for a long time. But if I think about Tangible Equity, I think about my two kids, Rose and Oliver, and I think about a world where I don't tell them anymore that they've got to work twice as hard to get half as far because we've created something better. We've created something that's more fair, more equitable. They were part of that creation as well. So this idea that we don't need to just simply settle for navigating a system. What if we work to kind of dismantle the parts of the system that didn't really work? As an immigrant kid, all of my life was about playing the game. But what if we transcended the game altogether? What if we said we need to slay the game? And that's kind of where we really get to a point where our kids are part of being part of that just world change that we're looking for.
Yeah. Why has this word equity become such a bad word in certain circles, though? I mean, it sounds like you're trying to really put it on a really rigorous foundation and inclusive, a really truly inclusive foundation. Are there instances where you agree with some of the criticisms that have been leveraged against the use of that word?
Yes. And I think part of the challenge is whether you want to call it performative equity or cosmetic equity, there's a lot of people that just talk about equity. And when you talk about equity in certain ways that are not actually guided in that disruption, right? Things that are going to actually make a tangible difference, in disrupting that pattern between demographics and outcomes, we can get into a world where people just start doing pretty weird stuff. Right? If you think about it, what systemic change is happening when we decide to take a group of third graders, have them stand in line, and move forward and backwards on that line based off of whether or not they have a certain privilege or don't have a certain privilege?
Right. That's called the privilege walk.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, yeah. What I think about a privilege walk is it is a showcase. It is the kind of thing that can maybe make me feel like I am doing something that's equity work. But again, what actual work is happening? And sometimes part of what we do is we say, oh, but no, we really got to address mindsets, right? We got to have like courageous conversations about race because we got to have mindsets. But how courageous is your conversation if it never leads to an actual action? And actually, how much can I do with mindset if I never have a skill set to go with it, right? So yeah. A lot of times from the K-12 perspective, what this looks like is there's some teachers that look at certain types of kids and say, these kids can't. These kids can't. These kids can't. And a lot of times educators would be like, oh, that's a mindset issue. That's a belief issue. But I'm like, well, what if it was a confession that when I say these kids can't, I'm saying I don't have any idea how to create the learning environments such that all kids can. If it's not an issue of will, but an issue of skill, I can actually do something about that. I can work on and change that.
I get it. Like just when you just said that sentence, I'm like, aha, that's why you called it tangible equity. I get it now. No, that's so true because so much of it is performative. You're right. It doesn't translate into tangible anything.
Not only is it not even tangible, we've got this massive phrase that's used in equity work that it's almost like I don't even have control over it. And I think that's where it starts to become really funky. I cannot stand the term implicit bias. I believe that it exists, right? I get cognitively why that could be a thing, but I also think it's a very education thing for us to do. Because in education, we love letting folks off the hook. Like I'd rather, instead of thinking about all these secret biases that I may have and maybe kind of perpetrating on kids unknowingly, I'd rather focus on the explicit biases that I do have. Because we all have explicit bias. Part of why equity is so hard for folks to kind of grapple around is because we are in a world where it's like bias equals bad. Bias equals reality. I remember being at a party with you once, Scott, and you ended up in a really bad conversation for a really long time. And I was biased against being in that conversation, right? Like, I'm like, I don't want no parts of this. I'm out.
You peace the fuck out.
Right? That's what I do, right? I peace out. I'm like, I'm not dealing with this, right? Like when we talk about bias from a real kind of like cognitive level, any teacher who's ever had an opportunity to name a child, right? Name a child. When you start going through those potential names, you're like, mm-mm, not David. Mm-mm. I had David last year. Not going to happen. Oh, mm-mm. And we look at these things and we kind of joke and smile about it, but clearly bias exists. When equity has been sort of weaponized to this idea that like equity makes people feel bad, it changes things if we already presume that bias was present and we actually have to grapple with and deal with it. I want to name one last part about why equity has become a challenge. I think the way things have always been done has an incredible amount of momentum, right? The status quo has an incredible amount of momentum where even after the massive disruption of a pandemic, we can still see a lot of things reverting back to that as that norm. One of the things that are super important to be able to preface anytime you're doing equity work that's reducing the predictive power that demographics have on outcomes is that it's not always going to feel good. It's sometimes going to be a little bit uncomfortable. And in fact, even personally, anytime you are personally experiencing something where real growth is happening, there's often growing pains associated with that. We're not honest about that often enough. If we were honest about it, we'd realize like, this work we're about to embark upon isn't going to always feel great. There's going to be a lot of personal accountability, a lot of personal responsibility involved in this. And it's going to feel kind of funky. Not to say that it's bad. We have to acknowledge the feeling of stuff. This is not an academic exercise. It's a very personal, real growth experience that has to happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The trauma, loss, and uncertainty of our world have led many of us to ask life's biggest questions, such as who are we? What is our highest purpose? And how do we not only live through, but thrive in the wake of tragedy, division, and challenges to our fundamental way of living? To help us all address these questions, process what this unique time in human history has meant for us personally and collectively, and emerge whole, I've collaborated with my colleague and dear friend, Dr. Jordan Feingold, MD, to bring you our forthcoming book. It's called Choose Growth, a workbook for transcending trauma, fear, and self-doubt. It's a workbook designed to guide you on a journey of committing to growth and the pursuit of self-actualization every day. It's chock full of research from humanistic psychology, positive psychology, developmental psychology, personality psychology, cognitive science, and neuropsychology. So lots of themes that you hear about on this podcast. And it's aimed to help us all integrate the many facets of ourselves and co-create our new normal with a renewed sense of strength, vitality, and hope. Whether you're healing from loss, adapting to the new normal, or simply looking ahead to life's next chapter, Choose Growth will help steer you there to deeper connection to your values, your life vision, and ultimately your most authentic self. Choose Growth will officially hit the shelves September 13th, and you can pre-order your copy or the audiobook in the U.S. now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and all major retailers. If you're in the U.K. and Commonwealth, you can pre-order now at bookshop.org.uk. We truly hope this book helps you grow and thrive and become your best self. Okay, now back to the show.
Well, what do you think is the biggest challenge our young people, you know, will face as adults? And how can this notion of tangible equity prepare them for that?
It seems like a cop-out to talk about, like, pressure, you know, like peer pressure. And like, oh, there's so much pressure. But there's something about the definition of success that I start to grapple with a lot. I go around the country a lot, and a lot of the, we do a lot of parent workshops. And oftentimes our parent workshops tend to lean towards parents of kids that are in the gifted and talented programs or whatever throughout the country. And it's interesting because when I ask parents and families, how do you define success for your children? The kinds of answers we get are the kind of answers, Scott, that I think you really look at when you think about success, like want them to be like kind. I want them to feel like they've got like a good set of friends and have positive relationships in their lives and like are, you know, they've got a job they care about, that they're active in their community, all these things, right? But then I ask them another question. I'm like, all right, if you were your children answering this question, what would your kids say was your answer to how you define success? And they're like, oh, high test scores, really good report card grades, really high GPAs, checking up all the boxes for community service, getting into the good colleges. Like, so there's a disconnect. There's a disconnect where even the energy we spend living our lives do not connect with what our actual values are. So what I worry about for our kids is how much will they go about their merry way accepting the unacceptable because that's what you're supposed to do. We're in a system that breeds compliance. We're in a system of people who like are really good at compliance, who become part of these systems. So to what extent are our kids going to be the ones that can be like, what if there was a better way to do this? What if there was a different way to approach this? And my biggest worry is that there's not enough happening on a day-to-day basis in our K-12 education system that's preparing kids to ask these kinds of questions.
That's really sad. Well, like just tangibly, you're thinking are some of the biggest problems in education. Like what are we concretely getting wrong? Can you enumerate this a little bit?
So one of them I can name for a fact, take this whole conversation we see nationally around critical race theory, CRT, anti-CRT, critical race theory, whatever you want to call it. And it's become this boogeyman. It's become this thing. And there's a range of concerns from the outrageous to the sincere. And when I start looking at this, my approach is a little bit different. My approach is to say, okay, let's step back for a second. Why are people, particularly the ones that are sincerely having a challenge with this, why are people feeling this way? Why are people kind of getting to this space? And what I've come to realize is we wouldn't have anywhere near the challenge around a CRT conversation if we felt super confident that we were doing our job when it came to RCT, raising critical thinkers. And our response to that was to say, we actually created a platform for families, like an actual thing for families that they can kind of purchase directly. That's called Raising Critical Thinkers at raisingcriticalthinkers.us. It's an English and Spanish. And the idea is I can use this platform to engage my kids, my children, in critical thinking at home, because maybe, just maybe, if I was confident my kids knew how to think, I really wouldn't care if they could potentially be kind of indoctrinated about what to think. Because if you know how to think, you can't be told what to think.
Wait, this is such a good point. Let me just pause you a second. This is such a good point. And sometimes some of the ideas coming from critical race theory are actually inversely correlated with good critical thinking. I hear some stuff and I'm like, that doesn't even make sense, you know? So not all of critical race theory, just because the word critical is in there, means that involves critical thinking. So I think if you could give people those skills.
So, and I'm going to say this, critical often, for the purposes of academia, means like scholarly and pretty deep. And what happens when we try to take something that's scholarly and pretty deep and reduce it to an infographic, or reduce it to something that I can deliver in third grade, is things sound really weird and terrible. Okay, I'll give you a concrete example.
That's a good point.
Literacy is white supremacy. I'm like, wait, what? What are you talking about? Oh, like, okay, like reading and writing is white supremacy. I'm like, that doesn't even make any sense. How do you get there, right? And I can look at this from two ways, right? I can look at it by saying, like, you know, when they excavated the Jefferson compound in Monticello, they found 237 unidentified slates and all these like pencils and things. And it was clear that there was a secret school happening where these enslaved people, after a day of toiling in these fields, risked life and limb to learn how to read and write. So miss me on reading and writing is white supremacy. How do we get to that point, though? How does it even happen? It happens because of a legal case. There's a case here in Arizona about 50, 60 years ago where there was a girl, teenage mom, who had a kid, was going to give up the kid for adoption. And in the contract, it said there was a 6-month finalization period. Okay? 6-month finalization period. About 3 weeks later, she decided, you know what? I changed my mind. I don't want to go through with the adoption. And the court said, okay, she changed her mind. It's whatever, like, it's fine. But then what they realized was the actual document said 6 months with the finalization period, but she only had 2 weeks to change her mind. She was past that period. It didn't matter that she understood it, that she had 6 months to change her mind. It mattered that the document said that this was the case. A document that she probably didn't really know how to read. A document that she clearly did not actually understand. So what we say in contracts law is this level of like force, right? Where sometimes this law can force people into these kinds of outcomes where it's like, you're saying that what it says on paper matters more than what I actually believe and understand. So in that way, you can say we have an injustice that's kind of baked into it, where we said that what's on words matters more than what's actually in my mind and in my heart. But that's a big jump between that and reading and writing is white supremacy. So there's a level of nuance and understanding that's hard to translate when you start taking really complex ideas and putting them in the classroom, which is why I'd rather use your own curriculum. I'd rather use what you're already learning. If you're learning circles in school, a circle is a set of all points equidistant from a single point. If that single point is an elementary school in your school system, and we got to find how far we got to walk in each direction to find a healthy grocery store, that's not a circle anymore. But that idea of food deserts gives me a why of why to even care about a radius, why to care about a circumference, right? So that's kind of the distinction.
Well, give me more examples of what falls within the purview of critical thinking. You know, what kind of skills? Give me some concrete skills that you think should be taught.
Let's say I'm a history teacher and my kids are learning about the Revolutionary War, right? The way that I learned, the way that you probably learned, was to memorize all the facts, dates, and figures of the Revolutionary War. But what if we were to ask our kids, what was the most important date of the Revolutionary War? Who's the most significant person in the Revolutionary War? What was the most significant event of the Revolutionary War? We can clearly see that we've got some kids who can sit there and by rote memorization tell you every fact there is to know about the Revolutionary War, but struggle to make an independent argument as to what the most significant date was and why. And what's cool about this idea, the tangible equity model, is it presumes that your identity is a really important part of getting there, but in a different way than most of the time when we talk about identity. When I think about identity from a learning framework, my question is, who's the most significant person in your household? What is the most significant store in your community? What has been the most significant date of your life? Now, it's about you. Now you're able to read significance from a lens that you can relate to because it's literally you.
Well, I think there's just this very interesting idea of should critical thinking be taught in schools? And then The question I want to know is, like, how much do you think things should be taught through the lens of race? I mean, don't you think there is some valid criticism against infusing the curriculum too much with drawing people's and children's attention to the racial differences in the classroom?
I do think that there's a level of understanding the world and definitely understanding the United States of America where you can't say that you understand the history, you understand the present, or that you will understand the future if you don't understand the way that racial injustice has actually kind of played in to where we're at. The question is always the how. Like, how do we get there? How do we get to the point where we understand kind of where we're at and how things work and what it means today? What it means today. So I think about this and talk about this a lot in the Tangible Equity book. The phrase white privilege is a very unfortunate phrase, okay? If that was a phrase that, like, the concept was being generated by a Black person, I don't think they would have used the words white privilege. It's inherently confrontational. If you tell me white privilege, I'm in a fourth generation of a trailer park in Kentucky, I'm not necessarily going to feel like there's a whole lot of privileges that come with my whiteness right now, right? So what are we even saying that for?
Yeah, was that idea created by D'Angelo?
Oh, that was Peggy McIntosh back in, like, 1989, right?
And is she a white person?
She's a white woman that is a woman studies scholar who decided to kind of take the idea of concept of male privilege and see how that might be applied if we talked about it from a racial issue.
I didn't even know that. So thanks for that. Thanks for that history. Yeah, I didn't even know who coined that term. Yeah.
And my problem with privilege is that, like, what we ignore when we just talk about white privilege or whatever is we ignore the reality that everybody has privileges. Every single person has a set of privileges. And in fact, you know, one of the most revolutionary things I did when I was in undergrad at Syracuse is I took a women's studies course where we had to keep a privilege lodge, a privilege log. And what it was we just noted things that were something that we had, that was somewhat an advantage that we didn't earn. We didn't earn this advantage. Like, one of the things I realized, I was back home one weekend in New York, because I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm on a train station. And I'm realizing there was a man on a wheelchair who was really studying the subway map. And I'm an expert at subways, right? I know all the things there is about the New York subway. And I was like, hey, do you need some help getting where you need to go? I can give you some advice, whatever. He's like, no, I'm just trying to confirm that this station has an elevator. I said, crap. That's a privilege. I never have to plan my route along, like, which station will have an elevator that I can get out. And I ended up getting off at the same stop as him. And guess what? The elevator didn't work. And now me and one other person had to help bring him up the stairs. And I'm like, I never have to worry about if I go to a place that's not working, is someone going to help me up the stairs? So when I start thinking about these things, it's like I'm living in a world where I have a conscious of where I'm at. I have a conscious of, like, why my world and my worldview might be different than others. If you're doing this instructionally, it could be like I'm in a classroom and I'm looking at three blind mice, see how they run. They all ran after the farmer's wife. She cut off their tails with a carving knife. And I'm asking these kids, like, what's hard about being a blind mouse? What are some of the challenges you might encounter as a blind mouse? Maybe it's harder to get to food. Maybe you're more susceptible to prey. Well, what are some alternative reasons as to why you might've been running after the farmer's wife? Maybe you weren't trying to scare her. Maybe she smelled like cheese. It's not always about you, lady. These are the kinds of things that if our kids start to adopt that kind of thinking earlier, it builds the empathy. So when I think about the pathway to understanding the way that race kind of plays out in different things, it's more about building empathetic folks who can relate, understand, be persuaded, like, oh, shoot, people have different struggles than I have. That's good to know.
Yeah, that's a really nice definition of privilege. I wrote this down, advantage you didn't earn. It's simply that, isn't it?
It's simply that. And sometimes you could say you earned it, right? But, like, it matters that I went to Syracuse and that I bleed orange. And if I'm at a bar with Syracuse people, I might be able to get some free drinks from those folks over there, right? Because we've got that commonality. Maybe being a part of your community for 3-4 generations comes with its own set of advantages. Being a part of a particular church or religious practice comes with its own set of privileges. So, like, when we start looking at privilege as something that's not just exclusive and restrictive, but something that's expansive that can be leveraged to help. Right? I had a privilege as a new teacher because new teachers are stupid. New teachers are all about hope and optimism. So people let you do dumb stuff when you're a new teacher, right? So, like, I really want to have a much more open understanding of, like, these things that bind us together.
I completely agree. Do you ever feel, though, sometimes people talk about, throw that word privilege around in cases where it doesn't really apply to a person, and that person can rightfully so get upset. So for instance, what about someone who, let's say there's a white person who came from a really, really poor background, and they really did have to work their ass off to earn what they did. So that doesn't fit within your definition of privilege. And then someone comes up to them and they're like, you privileged fool, you know? Like, doesn't that person have a right then to say, well, first of all, they could say, like, technically, according to Colin's definition, I'm not, that wasn't a privilege. So you're incorrect in that way.
Well, I can get the feeling, which is why I don't like the phrasing ever. I don't like the way that that's kind of determined, right? I don't like the way that that's out there. But I had this experience once where I was a keynote speaker at a conference and I was like at the top of the world, super excited and like talking to all these people afterwards. I'm like, oh man, that was a great talk. I was really inspired by this message. Awesome. And then a guy that came a little bit later, you know, saw my banner for Think Law and saw all my stuff for Think Law there at this booth. And he's like, oh man, I was running late, but I heard amazing things about the keynote this morning. I'm like, yeah, yeah, it was great, great impact, whatever. He's like, yeah. So is that Colin Seal guy going to be back here later? And I'm looking at him and I'm like, what do you mean? And I went from being top of the world to feeling super, super small. And whatever the case is, right? Mm-hmm. I think that when I talk about that exhaustion, Scott, when I think about like what it's done to my psyche over time, it's like, it would be awesome if in all the reasons I could think that he could look at me and just know I wasn't the keynote speaker, that the color of my skin wasn't one of them. I wish I had the privilege to know that the color of my skin was not the reason or a reason that he didn't see that I could have been the keynote speaker.
You don't know for a fact that it was through the lens of race, though.
I don't know for a fact, but even the idea that I can live my life and not have to think that that is a part of why this happened could really change things.
Well, hold on. Let me play devil's advocate. Let me just, because sure. you're all about critical thinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, what if like, we have stereotypes about everything. What if someone has a stereotype about the name Colin and they look at me, you know, like a Jewish guy or whatever, and they're like, when's Colin coming back? Because I don't look like a Colin either. Now, would I get upset over that? Probably not. Now, like, how can you give the most charitable interpretation of people while also recognizing that racism does truly exist, I guess is my question.
So my thing is this, emotions matter. Feelings matter. As much as I care about critical thinking, I care about the emotions of people experiencing them and those emotions having power, right? So like I can give them the most charitable interpretation of what happened and go through this, right? And it's fine and I'll live my life, but I'll never forget how small I felt in that moment when I realized that like it's a possibility that my race has something to do with this. When I was in law school, we had this thing called bar review, which sounds like academic, but it's not. We just went to different bars every week, okay? And one time I'm at this thing, and I was at law school in Las Vegas. There weren't a whole lot of Black students there, and I was there, and I was asking a question about the specials that they had for the drinks, and a law student that was there was like, the specials are only for law students. Now, sure, he could have just thought that I wasn't in the law school because he didn't know me personally, or because I was Black and in this space, and he was like, oh, yeah, like it was an easy way for him to be like, oh, this guy's probably not with the group, right? Again, I don't know for a fact, but the feeling of it matters. And I'm a grown man who's been through some stuff, right? Yeah. Our kids experience stuff like this, and it might not have the same kind of capacity. My kids went to a school where in a Montessori pre-K program, a girl said, oh, I didn't invite you to my party because we don't have brown people at our house.
Yeah, well, that's explicit racism.
That's explicit, right? And that's out there. A lot of times we see racism, we see that in your face kind of thing. What I'm trying to get towards, what I'm trying to push towards is a space where the way we sort of move is to understand that, like, I want to be brave enough, Scott, to be in that same moment with that guy at that conference and say, hey, question though, why didn't you think I was a keynote speaker?
Yeah, I want to know. I want to know too, yeah.
I want to be brave enough to be able to do that, right? But in that moment, I'm embarrassed for the both of us, right? Because if it is because of the race, then that's really hurtful. It's really hurtful if that's actually the case.
There's a really profound point here that I just feel like generalizes, and I'm trying to see how I can articulate it. Because first of all, I want to completely honor your experience in that moment. Nothing I'm saying, even just having critical thinking discussion with you about it, takes away from the fact that, you know, I really want to honor how that felt and how small you felt in that moment. And I felt that too in certain aspects of my life, and it's a terrible feeling. But I think there's something that just generalizes about this idea of privilege. And you raised this earlier. You said we all have our privileges, which means that we all lack something that someone else has a privilege for. You can even think of it. I try to think of just examples, like zoom out from race. I just want to zoom out from race for a second. Let's say you're short and ugly. You know, like you go through your whole life. You'll think like every time a girl rejects you, let's say you're a short and ugly guy. Every time a girl rejects you, you might think is it because I'm short and ugly? You know, like I'm trying to apply the same logical principles you're applying to African Americans, which is a very valid point, but just generalizing it into something a little bit more general about how just to have more empathy for our fellow humanity and recognizing. And we all have our privileges, but we also lack something that someone else has as well. We all do, right?
I think that introspection is really important, especially since I talk about like identity is a real part of seeing the world. Like, because obviously who we are informs a lot of how we see the world. You know, yeah. Our values, our expertise, our education in school, our education out of school, all these things are really incredible. And if we start to see the assets that we carry, it changes the way we move about the universe. Like it definitely does. When I think about privilege, just kind of like one more point on this, it's that sometimes when I'm looking to get something done, right? I got this whole thing about like, what happens when we actually want to do something about equity, right? There's this power. I know I have power. Even if I feel like I'm just a teacher, I'm just a low-level employee, like I have power. I got decisions that I'm trusted with to make every single day. I've got things within the scope of that power that are in my purview. And then I can leverage my relative privileges to increase the likelihood that this thing actually happens, to increase the likelihood that this thing is going to be successful, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think I can use the example in the book of, you know, I was doing this algebra boot camp thing when I was in DC, but I had done the National Society for Black Engineers when I was a computer science graduate at Syracuse. So that NSBE chapter, National Society of Black Engineers, I knew they had a big one at Howard. I'm like, my tutors are going to come from them because they've got the privilege of being even younger than I am and being kind of cool math kids. Cool black engineers to work with my I don't do math kids, right? Because some of my kids who said I don't do math, now they see really cool, well-dressed, super cool college kids. They're like, this guy's so much more cool than Mr. Seal. And now they're rocking out and getting all this stuff because I realized I had privilege and I leveraged it. And my point at the end of the day is we'd be in a better place if people acknowledge the privileges that we did have and double down on that when it came to making things happen towards this tangible equity goal.
So I completely agree with that. And I just got chills. I just got chills when you said that. Okay. I love that. And this is what I'm trying to grasp for as well. And thanks for, you know, I get better at articulating my point through conversation with you. So thank you. So the word privilege is such a loaded word. And in a way, it would be better if we deloaded it. So we didn't just view it like, oh, you can never have, so black people can't have any privileges. You know, you hear white people saying that too sometimes, right? Like, oh, you're saying no black people can have any privileges. It's like, okay, calm down. First of all, it's a very loaded word. It's not used to divide people. I would love if we could start using this word in a way to unite people and for us to see we all have our vulnerabilities and we also all have our unearned privilege. We all have our unearned advantages, all of us. And there's just some way that as I'm grasping for something here that's more humanitarian, more humanistic than the way that this word is used in our public discourse.
And I think a way to get there is to go all the way back down to like the first P that we talk about for making change, which is power. We say we all have power. We all have power. What it forces us to do is confront the negative relationship we usually have with that word power. Most of the time, people that struggle with the word power are so used to power being done against them for bad reasons that like power could feel scary. Power could feel like greed. Power could feel like oppression. But if I think just literally, what is power? It's the ability to do stuff. The ability to do something, right? So if you look at the cover of Tangible Equity, you'll notice that like there's a little toolbox. And two things are in a toolbox, an outlet and a mirror. Sometimes I need an outlet because you got to plug in the thing to access the power that you have already. Yeah. Like plug it in. Yeah. And the mirror is just a reminder like, oh, shoot. Yes. Yes, I do have power. I sometimes forget that I'm not sitting here talking about, oh, let's empower our families. Let's empower our students. Let's empower our educators. You already have the power. Will I allow you to showcase your power? Will I allow you to, like, in this meeting with all these people on this board, to object, to object, to raise a question, right? Like, if we have a space where that becomes normal, because I think going all the way back to sort of like this premise of the intellectual spaces we need to create, where I was wrong in my first book was obsessing over like critical thinking. We need to unlock critical thinking. Thinking like a lawyer could be a way to unlock critical thinking and brilliance. But what I realized over time is there's a much more important prerequisite question we have to ask. And that question is, do our kids even have the psychological safety to be brilliant?
Yeah.
Are we given these learning environments set up in such a way where our kids have the safety to be brilliant, to be critical thinkers? But we've all worked in a space that wasn't like that. We've all had a set of friends who were not those kinds of friends where you can share that with, in different circles where it wasn't psychologically safe to object, to voice dissent. This conversation we had right now, Scott, we probably could even have it in public. But are people chiming in and be like, I don't like what y'all are talking about. I'm offended.
We are having this in public right now.
Right. But like, if it was you and me in a public space where people were free to interject, we would have people that interject and get uncomfortable.
Oh, we'll hear it. We'll hear the comments. We'll still get comments. Sure. You know, but I hear you. I hear you for sure. Let's apply a lot of what we're talking about today to this sticky wicket of gifted education. Some people have, some schools have cut gifted education programs, and their justification is because of equity. Now, what are your thoughts about that?
So it's pretty straight lined, right? Like, I can get this idea that, like, okay, all kids have gifts and talents, without a doubt. And I could also say that we need to acknowledge that we do have some set of kids where they've got this asynchrony between where they're at, you know, intellectually, academically, and where they're at when it comes to age and social development, where if we don't deal with that asynchrony, there's going to be some funk that might ensue, right? There's going to be some challenges to really set that kid towards the chart for excellence that they're sort of meant to get to, whatever have you. And let's be clear, education has a lot of things we don't get right. We have a lot of inequities that are baked into what we're doing. It's also clear that, like, there's a lot of legacies around really bad stuff like eugenics and segregation that are associated with the foundation of gifted education. That said, if equity means that we're reducing the predictive power that demographics have on outcomes, can we just be honest about something? We've got some kids that, because of resources that they have outside of school, no matter what academic program you offer in your school or don't offer, they'll be good. They're going to get access to that eighth grade Algebra 1 program regardless. So I like to use that example often because I could look at school systems that are very diverse, and if they have eighth graders taking Algebra 1, sometimes that class itself does not reflect the district demographics. So equity can't be, okay, no one else is going to be able to take eighth grade Algebra 1. We're going to ban it. Equity can never mean everybody gets nothing. What would real equity look like, though? What if we said, my K through 7 model is going to be geared so that 100% of my kids will have an at-bat at Algebra 1 in 8th grade. You want to disrupt stuff? Every kid has access to Algebra 1 in 8th grade. That would put so many more kids on track to take advanced level AP math courses once they get into high school. It can, like, break things. Maybe some kids won't be successful. Well, they'll just try it again in 9th grade. Big whoop-de-doo. Right, but that's transformational. That's actually changing something. Putting this chart where that demographics to predictive outcomes thing isn't so predictive anymore. So are we willing to do that kind of work? It's really easy to do the performative cosmetic equity that makes us feel good and we can say equity. But if we're not actually changing the outcomes and creating these opportunities through changing those outcomes, what are we doing?
Yeah. Isn't it also kind of like signaling the message that you don't think minorities who are underrepresented in gifted programs are capable of excellence? Like, when you cut the program, aren't you kind of saying that? You're saying like, oh, well, they're not even capable of excellence, so we should just cut the whole excellence program. It feels like there's an implicit bias there. Yeah.
Joy, again, explicit. It's right. It's explicit.
Oh, it is. Yeah, you're right.
None of these kids are gifted anyway, right? Like, we're basically kind of rolling it out. Right. Joy Lawson Davis talks about that a lot. It's one of the most egregious forms of bias that comes out there. And again, I want to give an example of this disruption, okay? when I talk about power and privilege and all this stuff, one thing that I have a privilege about right now is I know a lot of folks in the gifted education space, right? I have a keynote at a lot of national and state conferences and work with a lot of districts around this work. And this intersection of gifted inequity is what I do a lot of. So I started realizing that so many districts that are doing things like, oh, I'm going to do local norms, I'm going to test everybody or screen everybody, we're still seeing these discrepancies where certain kids were underrepresented. And I started realizing, you know what's wild? Teaching force overall is not that diverse. But in gifted education, it's even less diverse than the overall teaching field, which is already much less diverse than the kids we're serving. What if we got to the space where if we change the face of who gets to teach gifted, we might be able to change the face of who gets to be gifted? Turns out there's research that says that Black and brown educators are up to 3 times more likely to identify Black kids as gifted. I started thinking about bees because there's this whole thing where bees were like, they're not supposed to fly. They're too fat. Their wings are too short. But like scientists were comparing their wings to the way that birds go up and down. But bees go forward and back with a little bit of a backswing. If you know how bees fly, it makes sense that they're always supposed to fly. So I started thinking about these Black and brown educators, like maybe they intuitively know that that bee was always supposed to fly. So I started a nonprofit arm in my work with Think Law called the Bee Project, where we just got 14 Black and brown educators here in Arizona certified and endorsed as gifted educators. Because again, if we change who gets to teach gifted, we might be able to change who gets to actually be in these gifted programs. Because we have so many districts where kids actually go through all the screening, pass, and they're like, yeah, I'm not sure this program is for me. If the teacher there actually looks like you, it's hard to say it's not for you. So this is the kind of example of the type of thing that you might be uniquely privileged to do given your space. But will we do it? Will we do the kind of thing that's going to create more opportunities where they don't currently exist so we can disrupt that pattern? But one pattern I don't like is a lot of Black and brown educators, for all we talk about with recruiting them, don't stay in the classroom long as their white counterparts. How do we change that?
Yeah, you're addressing these from different issues than you normally hear, and people arguing how to address those issues. For instance, a lot of people focus on universal screening. They focus on the testing side of things, as opposed to, you're like, well, it actually matters who's doing the teaching in the gifted ed program. And this is a larger point that you're making me think of, and that's that, you know, people spend so much time in the gifted education field obsessing over the measurement of and identifying the right kids. And then there's like very little discussion about like the quality of the program itself. And like, what are the kids going to do when they're actually in there? And so much of the funding goes towards the screening as well. And the funding doesn't go towards as much in picking high quality gifted education teachers. So I really like that you're focusing on that side of the equation.
And then there's the who cares factor too, right? Like who really cares? Like, why should I be concerned about this? Like who cares? So I think sometimes we like being in our little boxes. We like being in our little, like, oh, I'm the ugly stepchild of my district. Sometimes we like that. And I'm like, but what if there was something more powerful than this, right? Like, I know with all the work you've done with twice exceptional children, I consider myself blessed and lucky that I was identified gifted at 7 and diagnosed with ADHD at 37. Because I fundamentally feel that growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and our school system, had that been reversed, I think I would have been screwed. I think that instead of me asking questions as being deemed as curious and inquisitive, like, oh, that's a troublemaker right there. That would be true. I am a troublemaker, but I would be a bad troublemaker instead of a good troublemaker.
Yeah. I hear you. I think you're right. I think the unfortunate thing is you're right. And also allowed yourself to come out as ADHD on your own terms and set the narrative how you want to set it. I mean, imagine if you were diagnosed. A lot of these kids that are diagnosed with learning disabilities, they have no say in how they want to set the narrative or how they want to integrate it into their self. They're just forced to they're branded. That's it. They're branded.
Yeah. And then the thing that's so wild about this is the older I get, the more I realize like really in an ideal world, every kid would have an individualized education plan. Like everyone, it's like we said, differently privileged, right? Like we all kind of see things and learn things a little bit differently. And some things we got are easy. Some things we take a little bit more of a struggle. But like, why are we not seeing this as a more universal approach to stuff? And my whole thing is like, why can't we just shift the conversation altogether? Which is like, it can't just be about closing the gaps. How could the highlight of education be that somehow now Black and brown kids are doing as well as white kids when white kids aren't doing that great? What is that? What if instead we obsess with shattering the ceiling? shatter the ceiling.
Yeah, no one's doing that great. No one's doing that. I love that. Well, maybe we should just end on that point. Let's end on the note, shatter the ceiling. I kind of like that idea.
I think a part of that too, going back to like, you asked me like, what's different about the last 2 years? What happened? I think there's some things we've looked at casually as fine, but are actually unacceptable. Right? If you want to be inspired, follow hashtag Black Girl Magic on Twitter, right? You'll see amazing stories of Black women doing amazing things. Like, oh my God, this woman got her PhD and did this and this and this and earned this thing and got the special award, all these great things. But what I say is this, how we created this as a norm, where we've got Black women with unbelievable talent, unbelievable potential, and it takes magic for them to succeed? Because we don't have a system designed to unlock and nurture excellence. That's not our system. We have a lowest common denominator system. What if we didn't have that anymore? That's what I want to push us towards. An idea of tangible equity that we can actually be excited about. We can have this kind of disruption that would make us fundamentally feel in our hearts and minds that our world is better because of the work that we are doing to contribute to the world being better.
Preach, brother. Preach. I love it. I love it. Colin, man, thank you so much for coming on the Psychology Podcast again. You know, I'm a big fan of your work, and I just love the way you're thinking about these issues in a really nuanced and practical fashion. So thank you so much.
Can't wait to see you at the next party. I promise to save you this time. I'll save you. I got your back next time.
That's so funny.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.